log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
فیلم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه و jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
among پیغمبر اکرم نمونه.
The holy prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از ایمان.
Self purification is the most significant fact.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
امام صادق پشت بام منزلشون یه جایی بود خودشون گاهی می رفتن.
امام صادق علیه السلام had a small room on top of his house. This room was a private place for the imam to worship or study. Thus, nobody was allowed to enter that room without the permission of the imam. Once, when Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam entered his house, he found one of the female servants on the stairs to the room while having Imam's child in her hands. Upon visiting the Imam, the lady was shocked and left the child from the top of the stairs. The child fell down and died.
سفیان سوری میگه من رسیدم دیدم رنگ امام تغییر کرد.
سفیان سوری, one of the companions of the imam, saw that imam's face became pale and he thought the reason for that is the death of the child. However, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam stated, O Sufyan, my pale complexion is because of the fear that I created in the heart of the female servant. How shall I answer Allah on the day of judgment because of this deed? because of creating fear and awe in the heart of that lady. Then Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam asked that lady to forgive him and let her go free. As you can see, even creating a small fear in the heart of a Muslim brother or sister is absolutely prohibited in Islam, and we must avoid any type of frightening act. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The United States always proclaims itself a leader for promoting democracy worldwide. In line with such mentality, the administration of President Joe Biden hosts a long-promised two-day virtual event, calling it the Summit for Democracy. The event on Thursday and Friday will be attended by over 100 countries. The White House says the gathering plans to defend democracy and human rights at home and abroad. China, which has not been included in the list of invitees, has challenged the U.S. claim of upholding democracy.
No matter how the U.S. glosses over itself, its true face of seeking hegemony under the guise of democracy has long been exposed to the world. The so-called Summit for Democracy will only go down in history as a manipulator and a saboteur of democracy.
Russia, which has also been excluded from the summit, already slammed it as a product of America's Cold War mentality and warned that it will stoke up ideological confrontation and a rift in the world. This is a stance that experts have doubled down.
I think it's a dangerous game that the US is playing. They're sort of drawing a line of division in the world and creating an us-against-them environment, just as they did with the Cold War against the Soviet Union.
The inclusion of some invitees, such as Israel, has also drawn strong criticism given the atrocities the regime has committed against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. Irrespective of the names of invitees and those that have been excluded, the U.S. military adventurism seems to be overshadowing the summit. America's invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and its support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which have resulted in the loss of tens of thousands of innocent lives, challenge the U.S. claim of democracy promotion. Besides, humanitarian impacts of U.S. sanctions on countries that refuse to give in to its hegemony contradict such a claim. Ironically, the U.S. itself has a checkered record of human rights due to its racist approach toward minority groups, including African Americans. Advocates, analysts, and international observers have also cast a spotlight on voting rights in the United States ahead of the summit.
In recent times, clearly, the United States is not functioning as a democracy. It is functioning as a plutocracy. A democracy is a government of the people, by the people, for the people. A plutocracy is a government of the 1%, by the 1%, before the one.
A recent Harvard University poll found that over 50% of young people in the U.S. believe that the country's democracy is in trouble. With such an outlook, it remains to be seen how the U.S. wants to promote global democracy by holding a summit.
The European Commission says in recent years, EU member states have been intimidated by foreign countries in the area of trade. A new policy proposal has been unveiled to counter the use of economic coercion perpetrated by non-EU nations.
The EU considered the Iran nuclear deal to be one of its greatest foreign policy achievements. Do you think if we had more mechanisms like this in place before now, the nuclear deal would have been saved by now?
It's not the instrument which is there to resolve all problems, and we are clearly targeting it for economic coercion, but it certainly strengthens our toolbox to react to different possible situations.
Illegal sanctions introduced by Donald Trump when he was in office threatened there will be harsh consequences for any EU government or firm that does business with Iran. The former US president did all in his power to destroy the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The EU is currently mediating discussions in Vienna between Iran, Russia, China, Britain, France and Germany to try and save the accord.
This is the seventh round of talks this year. We hope that we will be able to move forward because there is no alternative. Diplomacy needs to deliver, and the only way how we can deliver is to have this agreement back on track.
The International Atomic Energy Agency repeatedly confirmed that Iran was fully complying with the terms of the JCPOA when Trump pulled the US out of the UN-backed agreement in 2018.
Senior EU officials have told me privately they are bewildered by the announcement on Tuesday from Washington that the US is to impose new sanctions on Iran as the talks in Austria proceed. A growing number of political commentators say Joe Biden is completely incompetent when it comes to foreign policy. They cite Afghanistan and the JCPOA as just two examples. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Inside the closed Sana'a International Airport, Yemen Civil Aviation Authority held a protest rally to mark World Civil Aviation Day. A number of state officials participated in the protest and slammed the continued closure of Sana'a Airport by the Saudi led coalition.
Today, we, like the rest of the world, celebrate the World Civil Aviation Day. This day means a lot for us as civil aviation workers, but unfortunately it comes as Yemen's airports are closed and being targeted in Saudi-led air raids. Sana'a Airport especially is being bombed in an unjustified way. The justifications made by the Saudi-led coalition that Sana'a Airport is being used for military purposes are incorrect. The United Nations is aware of the airport's activity and has daily flights through Sana'a Airport.
Protesters demanded the reopening of Sana'a Airport and called on the international community to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift its siege on Yemen. They held the UN responsible for not taking any action against Saudi violations.
Over 100,000 patients with chronic diseases have died due to the continued closure of Sana'a Airport, and there are about 400,000 more who are suffering from the shutdown. There are also 1 million patients who suffer from a lack of medicine that need refrigeration and must arrive through Sana'a Airport. The humanitarian situation is tragic and reflects the scale of the tragedy that Yemenis are experiencing due to the ongoing Saudi blockade.
6 years ago, Saudi Arabia imposed restrictions on Yemen's airspace and shut down Sana'a Airport. The closure has led to the death of tens of thousands of patients, including children, who needed to travel abroad for treatment unavailable in Yemen due to the collapse of the healthcare system. Thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, have died while waiting for a chance to travel through this closed airport, which is only receiving the United Nations flights. People here say the airport should also be closed to the UN to push the world body to take real measures against the Saudi blockade imposed on Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
B
The Russian leadership is extremely concerned about the possibility of large-scale hostilities in the eastern Ukraine, Donbas, and Crimea. There has not been such a level of military threat throughout Russia's modern history. NATO has dismissed Russia's proposal on zones of influence to somehow stabilize the situation. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has rejected a diplomatic dialogue, giving Ukraine carte blanche to withdraw from the Minsk agreements. The situation is more than ever close to a war. The United States has removed all diplomatic and political restrictions, while Ukraine's accession to the North Atlantic Alliance is a red line for Russia.
We are witnessing the expansionism of NATO led by the United States in the territories near Russian borders. That's why President Vladimir Putin is seeking legally binding security guarantees to prevent further destruction of the security system. If that does not work, our retaliatory measures will be harsh and the West will regret the missed opportunity for a deal with Russia.
Things appear to be heading toward a scenario of Russia's complete international isolation, an all-out technology and trade blockade, and an embargo on the purchase of oil and gas. To begin this plan, a military scenario might be implemented in Ukraine.
The NATO leadership understands that they have become weak and there is no unity inside. They need threats to maintain funding, and they create them by portraying Russia as an aggressor. That's why we do not hear a single word of condemnation from the West against Ukraine's escalation of violence in the East.
The Kremlin understands that passivity only makes things worse. The responsibility for the conflict will remain with Russia, and no one will be interested in the real picture.
It is unpleasant to negotiate with NATO and the US, and talks with Ukraine will not resolve anything because it is completely subordinate to Washington. Russia needs to remember one thing: the Anglo-Saxon respect only force. Russia must continue to strengthen its security and combat capabilities given the unacceptable policies of NATO and the US.
Russia demands legal guarantees since the West has not kept its promise that after the reunification of Germany, NATO would not expand eastward. Further advancement of Western forces and provocations will affect the fundamental security interests of Russia.
If Moscow's legitimate concerns about Ukraine and NATO are not taken into account, Russia will take retaliatory measures to correct the military strategic balance. An alternative to this could be long-term security guarantees on its Western borders. Марина Катунова, Москва.
The coronavirus continues to provoke sharply different responses across Europe. There has been much concern over the new Omicron variant, but markets are surging on the bet that worries about Omicron have been as overblown as they were for the Delta variant. France has had perhaps the strictest coronavirus measures in the West. But the government surprisingly announced only a handful of new minor measures and no new lockdown. Corporate profits and economic inequality continue to surge unabated during the corona era, and incumbent politicians may be thinking about this spring's election.
French businesses are accumulating a lot of debt because business conditions are far from optimal. We're going to see a lot of bankruptcies all down the line because sales are not rising, even though costs are. We need a long-term logic which is much more efficient, and even if we decide on even stricter sanitation controls.
The government also said schools will not be closed early for vacation, and they rejected a vaccination order for children, at least for now. France may have been swayed by a new report which found that during the first 15 months of the epidemic, not one healthy child between the ages of 5 to 18 died of COVID in Germany, Europe's largest country.
France's vaccination rate is now almost 80%. Prior to the pandemic, France was considered the most vaccine-skeptical nation in the world. But the introduction of a corona pass, which almost totally isolates the unvaccinated, has forced people into compliance.
Around Europe, lockdowns are back in Austria, despite massive protests. Germany is debating a vaccine mandate. Italy has moved to a new super health pass. And even though two-thirds of Europe is fully vaccinated, stricter measures may soon be arriving, regardless of the impact of Omicron. Perhaps the only certainty is that no government seems able to please all their citizens.
France's government has had a very poor strategy. For example, we provided free corona tests for a long time, but it was a major error because it cost us 6 billion euros. This money could have been used to create an actual screening strategy, which could have slowed the progression of the virus.
After 21 months of corona domination, what remains most unknown is when things will go back to normal. Europeans, especially non-vaccinated ones, are increasingly saying that time may be never. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Figures have just emerged which show that less than 55% of the population in six EU nations have received a COVID-19 vaccine, despite plenty being available. Experts say vaccine hesitancy is the main reason behind rising coronavirus cases, hospitalizations, deaths, and the reintroduction of restrictive measures across the 27-country bloc. EU health ministers have been meeting in Brussels to take stock of the crisis. So is this not a massive failure from the EU? Should the EU not be putting much more of its effort into trying to convince people to take the vaccines?
The EU citizens have moved forward, and we have over 66% of the total population vaccinated and 77% of the adult. But we mustn't stop.
Growing pressure on hospitals means that non-COVID patients are being neglected, and those without private health insurance are falling between the cracks.
Our member organisations are reporting on a daily basis of some of the barriers to access to healthcare, increasing co-payments, difficulties in accessing medicines, specialists, etc. This simply cannot go on.
As EU health ministers met on Tuesday, so too did the bloc's finance ministers. The message was both old and new risks to the EU economy are materialising.
Notably, the growing case numbers and reintroduction of restrictions, global supply chains, and the rise of inflation.
Bulgaria and Romania stand out as having the lowest vaccination rates in the EU. Fears over new variants have been heightened by the Omicron mutation. At the start of the pandemic, EU nations closed their borders and turned their backs on Italy, which was buckling under the pressure. It was left to Russia to fly in emergency medical supplies. It's a story the bloc's leaders never talk about. In a veiled reference to it here, health ministers say there must be better cooperation between member states when the next crisis emerges. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
It was a chaotic end to a 20-year-long U.S.-led occupation of Afghanistan. Thousands of Afghans who had worked with British forces appealed to be airlifted out of their country. Months after that shambolic evacuation, inflammatory claims about how the UK Foreign Office responded as the Taliban took over Kabul. 39 devastating pages of evidence provided by junior diplomat Rafael Marshall. Among the allegations, Marshall says up to 150,000 people applied for evacuation, but fewer than 5% got any assistance. No member of the team working on the evacuation requests had any knowledge of Afghanistan, and that Foreign Office staff stuck to the 8-hour shift culture during the emergency.
The truth of the matter is Afghanistan was a huge defeat for the Americans and for the British, and they didn't expect the government to fall so quickly. They didn't expect the Taliban to take control. The last thing they wanted to do was really bring attention to what went on there, and the evidence from this whistleblower makes that absolutely clear.
He reserves his most stinging criticism for former Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, holidaying in Greece at the time, for dragging his feet on responding to the crisis.
We had a process in place to check two things.
The former Foreign Secretary has defended his decisions, and we all remember these images. Marshall claims Prime Minister Boris Johnson personally intervened to secure the evacuation of animals in the care of a British charity worker at the expense of Afghans at imminent risk.
Marshall claims also that an email he wrote to his superiors warning that people could die if things didn't improve was criticized for being shrill. That claim and the others mentioned in this report raise serious questions about the dysfunction at the heart of the British government with deadly consequences. Saeed Khurza, London.
The
The World Bank spokesman has announced that donors to the Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund have agreed to decide about the transfer of funds to humanitarian aid agencies by December 10th. In the meantime, people in Afghanistan complaining about the ongoing crisis in their country call on the donors to let the flow of aid and unfreeze the blocked assets.
I expect the donors to stick to their promises. What are they waiting for? We have lots of problems, including poverty and unemployment. Everyone will starve if no aid is sent to Afghanistan.
The world countries have always said that they are after helping us. The situation is worsening as the winter is around the corner. We hope that the World Bank donors help us get out of this disaster by sending humanitarian aid.
Economical experts say that however the aid would be helpful, but the international community, in cooperation with the Taliban, must seek other stable approaches for Afghanistan's economy, rather than relying on temporary programs.
The Taliban should show flexibility against the international community's request to gain trust so that the aid could be handed over to the new government in Afghanistan. The transfer of the frozen assets can be very fruitful amid the current poverty that the Afghans are struggling with.
This comes as the UN bodies and aid agencies are calling for more urgent assistance as winter bites. World Food Program says that it needs $2.6 billion to ramp up life-saving support to reach 24 million people in 2022. The U.S. has frozen nearly $10 billion in assets of Afghanistan as it tries to keep the Taliban away from accessing the money. The U.S. sanctions on the Taliban have led to a wave of hunger and poverty in Afghanistan, pushing a large portion of the people to the brink of a catastrophe. Afghans now hope that donor countries agree to extend a helping hand. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's top NGOs and some unions rallied against the first presidential campaign stop of Eric Zemmour, a far-right journalist whose candidacy would have been unthinkable prior to the Islamophobia wave which has gripped France since the start of the great financial crisis. Zemmour is being called a Trumpian candidate for many reasons. He is not a part of any party. He has accused refugees of being thieves, killers, and rapists. He has been convicted of anti-Muslim speech and even wants to forbid giving babies Muslim names like Mohammed.
Zemmour is 100% racist. He should be kicked out of the race immediately based on the laws we have in place against racism. Zemmour profits from being a Jewish person in that he is being allowed to say things about race and religion which no one else would be allowed to say.
Zemmour thrives on outrage, but his popularity also stems from the fact that France's mainstream politicians have been totally discredited due to endless corruption scandals and kowtowing to the demands of Brussels and high finance.
The yellow vests oppose Zemmour and all fascists. We fight for the people and the rights which they are denied. Zemmour and Macron are the same dangerous sickness because they defend the rich class and also the same individuals. Both of them are just puppets who have the exact same puppet master.
It appears that the fight against Zemmour will serve as a safety valve because it's being presented in the mainstream media as a fight for progressive politics. However, even if Zemmour does not reach the second round, there appears to be essentially no chance that an even moderately progressive politician will take office in April. It's essentially a three-person race between Zemmour, the far-right's Marine Le Pen, who lost in 2017, and the incumbent Emmanuel Macron. Macron is on the far right economically and has also closed scores of mosques and forced the closure of the important NGO, the Collective Against French Islamophobia. The center and left is running behind the conservatives, making France's April election extremely right-wing and seemingly more right-wing every day. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Birthday of an immortal lady. In the name of God, the all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and heartiest congratulations to you on the occasion of a very blessed anniversary. Today, the fifth of the Islamic month of Jamadi al-Awwal is celebrated in the Islamic Republic of Iran as the Day of Nurse, to honor the services to humanity of these paramedics who strive day and night to ensure the recovery of patients suffering from various diseases. But what is the significance of this particular date for nurses? It is a good question, and the answer is obvious. Today is that auspicious day in history when the virtuous lady that nursed Islam back to life was born. She was none other than the heroine of Karbala, Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, the granddaughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Please stay with us for a special feature in this regard. It is beyond the power of ordinary mortals to pen the merits and virtues of Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, whose praise requires a tongue as eloquent as that of the Holy Quran, as heart-soothing as that of the Prophet of Islam, as expressive as that of her father as the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, as fluent as that of her brother, the martyr of Karbala, and as immersed in piety as that of her nephew, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him. Her genealogy is impeccable. She was a blue-blood scion of the monotheist house of Hashem, the noble leader of the Quraysh tribe, which was descended from Prophet Abraham's firstborn son, Prophet Ishmael, peace upon them. If her father, Imam Ali, peace upon him, continues to transcend history and all historical developments as the divinely designated vicegerent of her grandfather, the Almighty's last and greatest prophet, her mother is the noblest ever lady born on planet Earth, the Prophet's immaculate daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her. If the Prophet has the mercy unto the whole creation is her maternal grandfather, her paternal grandfather is that protector of infant Islam, the Prophet's beloved uncle and guardian Abu Talib, the consanguineous brother of the Prophet's father, Abdullah. If her maternal grandmother is Ummul Mu'minin, or mother of all true believers, Hazrat Khadija, peace upon her, also known as Malikatul Arab, for her fabulous wealth that she all spent for Islam, her paternal grandmother is Fatima bint Asad, the lady who brought up the orphaned Prophet as her own son following the death of his grandfather, Abdul Muttalib, and of his mother, Amina bint Wahab. The merits of Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, who gave her two youthful sons, Aun and Muhammad, as sacrifices for the cause of Islam at Karbala, do not end here. In view of the fact that her brothers were Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, peace upon them, the leaders of the Youth of Paradise. Moreover, she was married to her first cousin, Abdullah, the son of Jafar Tayyar, the first migrant in Islam, whose famous expounding of monotheism and the merits of Prophet Jesus and the Virgin Mary, peace upon them, in the court of King Negus of Abyssinia, present-day Ethiopia, when the polytheist of Mecca pursued him there, is recorded in golden letters. Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, was too great to rest on family laurels. She explored a distinctive path of her own, and that is the reason her virtues merited the title Saniye Zahra, or the lady who is second only to her impeccable mother, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, the greatest lady of all times. Hazrat Zahra, peace upon her, needed an immaculate deputy to demonstrate to the women of the world the greatness of Islam and the practical meaning of piety, virtue, and feminine rights. This is why her elder daughter, Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, rose to the occasion to carve out an immortal niche for herself in history. Although not infallible like the prophets, the imams, and her own mother, the heroine of Karbala set a lasting example of flawlessness that not even the infallible Adam could match because of his slight negligence in approaching the forbidden tree while in heaven. Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, was the embodiment of practical knowledge. The Iranian scholar Sheikh Sadur, who flourished over 1,000 years ago, writes, Zainab, peace upon her, had a special deputation on behalf of her brother, Imam Hussein, peace upon him. People used to refer to her in jurisprudential matters related to the sanctioned and the forbidden until her nephew, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, recovered from his illness. In view of this statement, it is knowledge that unravels all realities. In other words, there is no aspect of human life that does not require knowledge and awareness. Her father, Imam Ali, peace upon him, in his famous advice to his disciple, Kumail ibn Ziyad, as mentioned in the book Nahjul Balagha, has beautifully outlined the indispensable nature of knowledge as more worthy than wealth, saying, knowledge guards you while you have to guard wealth. Wealth decreases by spending, while knowledge increases by spending. In Islam, the pursuit of knowledge is not confined to men, but women are also urged to acquire it. Unlike other creeds and cultures, Islam restored to woman her natural status in society with emphasis on learning so that literate, knowledgeable mothers could properly groom their children, the future hope of the society. Thus, Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, was immune from any ignorance and possessed God-given knowledge with certitude. No less a personality than her nephew, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, says about her, "You are, by the grace of God, a scholar, unschooled by anyone, and a sage by connection." The fourth Imam, in praise of her eloquent sermons in Kufa and Damascus, when, in the aftermath of the heart-rending tragedy of Karbala, the noble prisoners were brought before the Umayyad ruler, has said that the realities and finer points of God-given intelligence and knowledge, his aunt demonstrated, is not easy to grasp by even the most erudite scholars. Her clarity of language and choice of words to expound the mission of her brother in the court of tyrant Yazid is rather unique. History is incapable of doing full justice to her sermons that ensured eternity for the mission of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Scholars pointing to a single phrase from her memorable sermon in the court of Damascus say that, besides being an indicator of her firm faith, trust in God, sincerity of purpose, and doubtlessness under the most adverse circumstances, it shattered to pieces the power and pride of Yazid. Her bold address to the seemingly proud caliph, "Is it justice, O sons of freed slaves?" shook the very foundations of Umayyad rule and exposed its illegitimacy not only for those present at the court, including the Byzantine ambassador, but for all generations to come. By her use of the word tolaqa, which plural of taliq or freed slave, Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, was actually reminding the ruler how her grandfather, the Prophet, on the day of the peaceful surrender of Mecca to Muslims, had shown magnanimity to the infidel Abu Sufyan, his accursed wife Hind ibn Utbah, and his equally criminal son Muawiyah, the grandfather, grandmother, and father of Yazid, despite the fact that Hind had so savagely carved out the liver of the Prophet's martyred uncle Hamza at the Battle of Uhud and tried to chew it. On the day of the liberation of Mecca, the Prophet had referred to Abu Sufyan, Muawiyah, and their other idolatrous kinsmen, tolaqa, or freed slave, and had spared their lives by accepting their lip service to Islam in order to teach humanity a lasting lesson that what evil such despaired and despised ingrates do when opportunity comes their way to strike at the humanitarian principles that they had always opposed. It is rightly said the immortal saga of Karbala would have remained incomplete if not for the endeavors of Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her. here was a sister who refused to let the mission of her martyr brother be confined to the epic day of Ashura, as the cowardly enemies of humanity had planned. Imprisonment did not dampen her spirits. She not just carried Imam Hussein's message to Kufa and made the Iraqis rue their betrayal of the Prophet's grandson, but also institutionalized its commemoration for all time. Neither did she allow the dungeons of Damascus and the jam-packed court of the tyrant Yazid to drown the eloquence of her sermons that eventually apprised the Syrians of the treason of the Umayyads against Islam. Nor was she content to merely lighten the burden of her bleeding heart and return home to Medina at the outpouring of grief of the people of Hijaz, shocked by the tragedy that befell the Prophet's household. Thus, when any conscientious mind turns to the epic of Ashura and the traumatic aftermath of history's greatest tragedy, it will acknowledge that Islam and all humanitarian values, without the least doubt, are also indebted forever to the lady whose indefatigable role earned her the title of Sharikatul Hussein, or partner in the mission of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Peace upon the granddaughter of the Prophet and upon those guarding her holy shrine in Damascus from the blasphemous attacks of the Zionists and the Takfiri terrorists.
Seven, they're in a pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only king.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. First and foremost, we would like to congratulate the Muslim Ummah on the birth of the daughter of Bibi Zahra Salamul Alayha and Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, the voice of Karbala, the champion of Karbala, the stalwart of Karbala, Bibi Zainab Salamullah Alayha. This being her birthday, we especially send our felicitations to the Imam of the time, Imam Sahib Al-Asri Al-Zaman. And we ask Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala to enable us to do the ziyarah of this blessed lady, whether it be in Egypt or whether it be in Syria, that we are able to go and, you know, pay our allegiance and pay our respects and recite the Holy Quran at the grave of this, you know, pinnacle of sacrifice for the cause of Islam. And we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to do so. So it's only fitting that on this day, being the birth of Bibi Zainab salamullah alayha, that we introduce a book that deals with her life. Now, unfortunately, in English, there's not that many books that revolve around the personality of Bibi Zainab salamullah alayha. And it's something that we need to work on. But alhamdulillah, there are a few available, and one of the books that are available, we will be mentioning in our next segment, and hopefully in the final segment, reading a bit from it to benefit our dear listeners. So please stay tuned for that segment, inshallah.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. And again, my felicitations and congratulations to all of you on this, the birth of Bibi Zainab, Our Lady Zainab, Salamullah Alayha, the daughter of Imam Ali Alayhi Salam, and Bibi Zahra, Salamullah Alayha. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is a book titled The Victory of Truth, The Life of Zainab Bint Ali. The book was written by Sister Mona Hairi Bilgrami, and this publication, or the one that is was found, was published by Ansarian Publications in Qom, Iran. But as we can see, as we will read in a short while, that it was publicly first published in Pakistan by the Peer Muhammad Trust, as for the foreword and acknowledgement that is present within the book itself. So this book basically deals with the biography of the daughter of Imam Ali alayhi salam and Hazrat Zahra salamu alayha. So it deals with her early life, and obviously no book about the life of Bibi Zainab salamu alayha can be complete without, you know, showing or at least mentioning the role that she played in Karbala, and obviously the even more important role that she had on the way to Kufa, in Kufa, in Sham, and then obviously the return to Medina. So the thing that is mentioned in the foreword that we would like to point out is that in the book it mentions that we wish to acknowledge the Peer Muhammad Ibrahim Trust for suggesting that we produce this book to commemorate the birth anniversary of Zainab bint Ali alayhi salam. So it is quite, you know, fitting that this book is what we would like to introduce today. This book closely follows the various narrations that have come to us from original sources. In producing this work, it was thought most appropriate to present the reader with an easily absorbed narrative. The language of this text has purposely been made simple and lucid so as to make it useful for youngsters as well as adults. So this is the crux of the book. One of the things that may come as a, you know, a defect of the book, if we like to say, is that many of the source references have not been mentioned. It may have been mentioned in the original text and not in the second one, I do not know. But this is something that when a reader goes through, you will see that the references in some places, or the places that I saw, were not available. But anyway, it is a very simple and a easy narrative. It is basically a story of Bibi Zainab from Medina back to Medina. So inshallah, in our next segment, for the benefit of our dear listeners, we will be reading a segment from this book, The Victory of Truth, The Life of Zainab Bint Ali, Salamullah Alayha. Please stay tuned.
Among the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. The book that we introduced to our dear listeners was the book titled The Victory of Truth, The Life of Zainab Bint Ali, written by Mona Hairi Bilgrami. So the section that we would like to read for our dear listeners is from the introduction of this particular book. So, introduction. This is the story of the victory of truth. It is the story of a unique woman whose own fate was inextricably bound with the historical events of Karbala that have impressed upon mankind the true reality of living Islam. It was on the plains of Karbala that the conflict between Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the pretender to the Khilafah, Yazid ibn Muawiyah, was waged in battle. Imam Hussein had steadfastly refused to pay homage to Yazid and acknowledge him as leader of the Muslim world.
It was no secret that Yazid flagrantly flaunted the laws of Islam and even publicly derided its beliefs. His claim to the Khilafat bore no legitimacy or acceptability in the eyes of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. It would be facile and dishonest to disconsider their confrontation as but an isolated instance of power jockeying in the early days of Islam. The issue on which they clashed is one that continues to be a source of needless antagonism among Muslims today, and that is, what manner of man has the right to rule the Muslim world, or indeed mankind? Could Muslims be ruled by one integrated, complementary set of laws rooted in the knowledge of Allah Ta'ala's supreme tawheed, or unity, or by a power that seeks to elevate temporal values to hard and fast law at the cost of allegiance to the sole source of all creation? This story unfolds through the life of Zainab al-Kubra, granddaughter of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, daughter of Hazrat Fatima and Imam Ali alayhi salam. From what we know of her actions and speeches, it is clear that in her was reflected the divine prophetic light that was her heritage. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to learn more about this blessed lady and to implement her sacrifice, her teachings, her mannerisms, her way of defending the imam of her time and Islam in our own lives, inshallah. Until our next episode, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.